Welcome. This is designed to be an outline of basic Buddhism. I won't be able to cover all the basics, but I can do a thumbnail sketch of pretty much everything that's needed to practice Buddhism. In my personal case, I find that my theory is way more advanced than my practice. And once you understand that practice is absolutely necessary to get any real results from Buddha Dharma, then you have to emphasize the practice. That means mindful meditation. That means whatever other practices, compassion practices, that you can take on. The Buddha Dharma is really mostly universal because it's about the human condition. And since we're in the same boat as humans, you know, we suffer during our lives. We suffer birth, old age, sickness, and death. And we wish for happiness, but we end up sowing the seeds of our own misery through our own negative actions. So that means we have the seeds of these negative actions, imprints. They call it perfuming sometimes. And these seeds can sprout whenever the conditions are ripe. They can sprout a long time after the act that planted the seed. And when you have things that you habitually do, such as getting angry over this or that or the other thing every time it comes up, then that kind of digs a imprint into the mind. And so you have the tendency to get angry again. So when you practice, you gradually diffuse this kind of thing. You know, you work on whatever afflictions are harming you the most to start, and then gradually work at it until all of these emotional hang-ups, these negative emotions, are cleared up. And the result of that is we don't cause ourselves any more misery. The karmic seeds continue to sprout. You know, what I did at 10 years old, good, bad, or indifferent, left imprints, and so I have a tendency in the future to act the same way. So what we're doing is countering our habitual behavior and trying to substitute spiritually and rationally excellent behavior for the way we've been in the past. And since what goes around comes around, if you begin starting now, planting better seeds, in other words, improving the behavior, cleaning up the act, so to speak, then the result is more happiness in the future. But the karmic seeds continue to sprout, so it's kind of a long road. The foundation of the whole practice business is mindful meditation. Mindfulness is absolutely essential. I would define it as outer and inner awareness. You know, you know where your body is, you know what you're doing, you know what's going on, you're present in the now moment. And from that moment, you can begin to get clear about what it is to be human. the mind goes to the past and the future. The mind can be 1,000 miles away. We remember time and again how that happens. But the body only exists in the present moment. You can only contact the body in the present moment. If you think about memories of the past, where's the body? You know what the body did, but the perception of the body is not there. And likewise in the future. You know, you can image your body doing a given exercise in the future, but the body itself is not there until the future moment arises as the present. So we want to stay with the body and stay in the present time. Usually to do this during the day, a lot, you know, everybody has moments of clarity, but we want to increase the frequency and duration of those little moments of awakening, those little moments of being clear about where we are and what it is. So to do that, we do formal sitting meditation of some sort. And the sitting meditation anchors the mindful efforts during the day. So again, my opinion, but what matters is the off-the-cushion mindfulness. And the meditation itself is simply a means to get to more mindfulness off the cushion. So any formal practice, and I think that goes also for compassion practice, it's a matter of increasing our natural proclivity to compassion, caring about others, by exercises that amplify it. And as you do these repeatedly, then the imprints of compassion are in the mind stream, and you're more likely to act from compassion when the opportunity arises or when the necessity arises. So basically, we do formal practice, we do meditational sitting in order to improve our consciousness level from moment to moment during the day. Now, as I said, Buddha Dharma is mostly universal. Everybody goes through moment after moment of consciousness, each one different. But mostly we don't notice that until we can slow down the mind enough that we begin to perceive the individual moments much more clearly. Early Buddhism especially, but also all of Buddhism, tends to be more about method than anything. There's a story about Shakyamuni Buddha. He was in the forest with a bunch of his monks and nuns, and picked up a handful of leaves and said, "Are there more leaves in my hand or in the forest here?" And of course they said, "Well, there's a lot more leaves in the forest." And then he said, "Well, what I have in my hand represents what I teach, and what's in the forest represents what I know." He totally designed his teachings in order to enable people to transform their consciousness into a better form, into a more awake form. So the basic Buddha Dharma has to do with methods and views to take, attitudes to take, that make our lives better and ultimately lead to an enlightened state. That being the case, we're certainly willing to share with the non-Buddhists any of those techniques that would be useful to them. The current mindfulness movement is now everywhere, and the hope is it won't get watered down too much, and that in fact people will become more mindful and therefore happier and therefore less likely to do stupid things the way many of us did, especially during adolescence, right? So the effort that you apply to a given practice, if it's consistent, is going to result in some kind of positive change. And again, the mindful meditation is absolutely essential. That's the cornerstone. Because without being aware of what we're doing, we're not going to transform our consciousness. We're on automatic pilot so much of the day. And what you do, you can't interrupt a lot of the automatic pilot, because it's like trying to ride a bicycle when you think of every move. Your body knows how to ride the bicycle. You know, you've learned that. The body has learned that. If you interfere with that automatic pattern, then it gets really difficult to ride the bicycle. So we need a lot of these automatic patterns in our lives just to function. But we have way too many of them. And some of them are totally unnecessary, and some of them are like vicious circles of negative thinking, which is especially what we want to defuse. So the Buddha Dharma is designed to be practiced, and it's designed to transform the psyche. Now, Buddhism as a religion has added a lot of bells and whistles, and it's possible to be devoted to the Buddha Dharma without really practicing it. But that will not lead to transformation. That may lead to a better cast of mind. It may lead to more happiness, more abundance. but it won't lead to enlightenment unless it's practiced. So I have to continue to emphasize practice as an essential. I'll outline the basic mindfulness that we usually use. It's kind of the essential beginning, but it's practiced on through the entire enlightenment career. You sit preferably cross-legged with the back straight, or in a chair with the back straight, everything relaxed, and you follow the object of meditation. There are some 40 of them. The one we usually use is breath. The breath is essential to our life. It's mostly unconscious, but if we start watching it, it becomes conscious. And a lot of people find it boring to watch the breath. So that's one of the first obstacles to overcome. You anchor your awareness of the body through watching the breath. And you can do it in the nostrils. And you notice, if you examine it, that the breath that comes into the system is cooler than the breath that's exhaled, because the body warms it up. So you notice little things like that. But basically, because it's so routine, the mind is going to especially wander. You know, our minds wander anyway during the day, but when you're focused on the breath, they wander extra much. And when you notice that it's wandered, return to the breath. And the time of formal meditation, 10 minutes minimum, 20 minutes is better, a half hour is good, hour at a time is better yet. Whatever you can do, 5 minutes even would work, but 10 minutes I would say is pretty much minimum. If you sit, then the mind wanders and you notice it's wandered and you bring it back. And it wanders again and you bring it back, and it's that constant motion of noticing and returning. And they say that initially the mind stream is like a cascade of water. It's just one thought after another. People that start out meditation that have not had any experience in it are totally appalled at how much their mind moves and how little control they have over it. And that's true of everybody. But what does happen as the meditation continues is that the cascade of thoughts slows down. And pretty soon it's more like the rapids, and it's not a waterfall anymore. And then eventually you get little gaps of non-thought, where you have awareness but no thought. And they're just little gaps in the flow of the mind stream. And that's what to focus on. When a gap comes up, focus on the gap. And then occasionally, if we're lucky, we get into a altered state of consciousness, you know, where things are more vivid than usual and clearer than usual. And when that happens, go with that. And then when the mind wanders, again, bring it back to the breath. That's the essential technique of mindful meditation. And then, as I say, you want it to be off the cushion, more moments of mindfulness.
What about counting?
If you're extra distracted, one of the techniques is to count the breaths. Counting up to 21 is good. And again, you discover, oh, I got to 17 and then I forgot what I was doing. So start over at 1. And some days it's hard to get to 21. And you can go to 7. You can count to 7 and return to 1. But it's a technique for slowing the mind down enough that the meditation can become more solid. And there are other techniques. If I want to stay awake during a span where my body is dozing a little bit, I'll sometimes put the fingernails into the palm. You know, that light little bit of pain is enough to keep me awake, hopefully. I went to a really interesting Kabbalah lecture one time, and the particular teacher made it difficult to follow because he droned, and he did that on purpose, and he droned on and on, and everybody was falling asleep. In that case, I jammed my fingernails into my palm so that I could try to stay awake, and I was able to track some small part of that lecture. It was very abstruse. So you can use techniques like that, but the whole thing is only techniques. You know, the end result is awareness of the present moment, awareness of what's going on inside the psyche, and awareness of what's going on in the outside world at that moment. I wrote, mindfulness meditation has various positive long-term effects. The disposition becomes calmer and less reactive. Moments of mindful awareness increase in frequency and duration during the day. Outer life gets better as negative emotions subside. Our expression becomes more positive. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths. The first teaching that Shakyamuni Buddha ever gave was to the five ascetics that he'd been practicing with for years. They did bitter ascetic practices. The rumor was they ate half a sesame seed a day, and they were all skin and bones, and they'd bathe in an icy waterfall in the morning and just beat their bodies all up. And he got to the place in that practice after years where he was a mess. He felt like he was close to dying. And so he left the group, and he proceeded to the Naranjana River under a big tree. He sat. That was the Bodhi tree, a peepal tree. Very beautiful leaves they have. And he made a seat out of kusha grass, and he sat there, and he determined he was going to sit there until he achieved his goal, which was full enlightenment. And it was already way advanced. He got to the very top of samsara. He could do all the four states of concentration, the four jhanas. He could do all the four formless meditations. But he still wasn't out of samsara, out of the world of suffering. So he sat under the tree. A woman came from the village. And again, this is partly mythology. I believe such a thing took place, but it got elaborated. So in the story, she had a golden bowl, and she brought this golden bowl of rice gruel, which is practically the only thing that you can eat if you've been fasting a long time. You know, if you fast a 7-day water fast, it's just difficult. You can't have any oil, any salt. You know, just the bland porridge is basically all you can eat until you open the digestive system back up, because it shuts down after a time of fasting. So it's really dicey to break a fast. And he had the ideal substance to break the fast with, and he divided it into 49 parts, and he sat there for 49 days, not moving from that spot. And then on the night before his enlightenment, he stayed awake during the watches of the night. And I'm forgetting the detail here, but on the first watch of the night, I believe he understood the law of cause and effect, the karmic law that governs our experience through our behavior. And he discovered that this was true of all people. And he could see the next watch of the night, he could see all the sentient beings in the world rising and falling from the heaven worlds to the hell worlds, lifetime after lifetime, coming and going, all bound by the laws of cause and effect. And then in the third watch of the night, he understood totally and completely the laws of karma. The subtle details of how karma works. It's what goes around comes around. It's like an action produces ripples in the universe, and then the universe responds with a counter ripple, as it were, and that produces an experience. So he understood all of that in its subtle detail, They say that it's impossible until you reach the path of seeing, which I'll describe later, the Satori, the early enlightenment, if you will, the moment of total awakeness. Until you reach that, the understanding of the Four Truths is only partial, you know, because it goes that deep. On the third watch of the night, he developed what are called the 12 links of dependent arising, which was his teaching about the laws of karma that he had perceived. And that's a very a brilliant formulation of his insight. And it works on all levels, moment by moment, and also lifetime by lifetime. Again, if there's time, I'll bring that up later. So you have, of the Four Noble Truths, the first is the truth of suffering. Every sentient being suffers. Even the people in the hell realms suffer the most. The people in the heaven realms suffer the least. But in this teaching, the gods, after a long span of life, die. And when a god dies, they get isolated from the other deities. Begin to rot. Their body stinks. They go through a similar phase of old age, decay, and death that humans do. And then, worse yet, they perceive where they're going to be reborn next. Because even though to get to the heaven realms, you've cleared up most of your behavior, the roots of the negative emotions still remain. And it takes serious yoga to extract the roots of these negativities. So you can end up in a beautiful place, totally calm, totally awake, and yet when that runs out, a root of a negative emotion can still sprout. So that's what happens to the gods. You know, they have earned a long span of a blissful life, that some of those roots of negativity still exist. And at the end of their life, they manifest, and they're going to be reborn in a lower realm, and that causes great suffering because they're used to being in the heaven realms. So there's no such thing in Buddhism as eternal anything. The Buddha Dharma is the middle way between what they call eternalism. Something is permanent. In this teaching, nothing is permanent that we perceive in our experience, it all changes. And likewise, it's non-nihilistic, even though there's a lot of emptiness in the teaching. In the original Theravadan tradition, the self is empty. There's no such thing as a self. We have a process of five what are called skandhas, and these skandhas are categories of experiential moments. I think of a moment as a molecule of experience, and these dharmas, these atoms of experience, are what make up the entirety of our experience. There's no self in it. There's just rising and falling according to cause and effect. One moment plants the causes of the next moment, and these dharmas occur in different combinations. They rise and fall, and the skandhas are just the categories of this process. Basically, there's body and material world as one of the skandhas. Then there's perception, which is defined as the perceptual apparatus all the way up to the recognition of what's perceived, and even the naming of it. So this samjna skanda, this perception skanda, is not what we ordinarily mean by perception. It's an extended version of perception. Then the third skanda is called feeling, vedana, and feeling is defined as the immediate reaction to a sense perception. So emotions are constructs that are added to the basic root, and we're looking at the basic process. That's where the meditation is to be going if you meditate deeply for hours. live in a cave and meditate for hours, for instance. Then the mind slows down enough to perceive these dharmas, these atoms of experience. But that's near impossible for us in this day and age. So we can still observe the skandhas. We can observe that there is a process moment to moment, and there's really no self in it. You know, I might identify with my experience, but if you think about it, the experience just goes on, irrespective of whether we identify with them as a self or not. So in the early Buddhism, the self was empty of a self. No such thing. There's only the skandhas. And then later in Mahayana Buddhism, the emptiness was extended so that phenomena themselves were considered unreal. They were empty of themselves. So that even these dharmas, these atoms of experience, these phenomena, are empty of any essential nature. They have no separate self-entity. You know, they're like soap bubbles that come and go. There's no substance to them. That's the teaching in the Mahayana. Okay, meanwhile, we have the truth of suffering as the first noble truth. We suffer the universal sufferings of birth, old age, decay, and death with sickness. And we experience the suffering of not getting what we want. We experience the suffering of getting what we don't want. And we experience the suffering, once we have something we want, the impermanence takes it away. It's going to rise and fall like everything does in this world. There's no real security in this world because things rise and fall, they're impermanent. And some things, like a mountain, may last a long time, but you know it's not permanent. It's going to get worn away by erosion. And likewise, our house is still standing for years and years, but that's not permanent. Nothing in our lives is permanent. And reacting to that is suffering. And getting used to the fact of impermanence is difficult to do because we're constituted in such a way that we like things to stay the same. You know, I have a good life right now. I'd just as soon keep it a good life. But old age, decay, and death is gradually taking that away. You know, my range is decreased. Things that I did as a youth I can no longer do. Body won't do it. And that's impermanence, and that is suffering. And likewise, old age, decay, and death is suffering, and everybody is subject to that. But there's another kind of suffering, idea of two arrows. The difficult experience of the moment, the pain of the moment, is like one arrow. And then our reaction, what we make of it, is another error. So we have a bad situation, then we make it worse by our negative thinking and possibly by our negative reaction, thus creating more karma. So the effort is to get that second arrow out of there and not react in a negative way to whatever happens to us. And that we practice during the day, so that when a situation comes up where there's really a lot of suffering, we can ride it out without creating more negative karma. That's the hope. So that's the truth of suffering in a nutshell. Then there's the truth of the origin of suffering. And this is not so universal among humans. Most people don't realize that the ethical cause and effect determines their experience. You know, people think, oh, I got away with that, so that's okay. But it's not, because you planted the negative seed and it's going to sprout. So gradually, we begin to perceive the law of cause and effect, at least in its approximate form. Oh, wait a minute, there are consequences for my actions. And these are not only social consequences, but they're experiential consequences. Now, a lot of people think that it doesn't matter what you do. You know, it's all You're born, you do whatever you do. If you get away with it, so much the better. Then you die and it's all over. Okay, that view is considered a wrong view in Buddhism. You know, we talk about rebirth, but it's not exactly like solid reincarnation where some entity gets reincarnated. We rather say that the last moment of life conditions the next moment of the new life. And all those karmic seeds are transferred to the new life. Now, where the new life is going to be is a different question. It could be in any of the six realms, the hells, the hungry ghost realms, unfulfilled desires, the animal realms, the realm of fear, the human realm, the realm of pride and reason, the titanic realm where the titans are fighting against the gods all the time, and the lower heaven realms, which are still in the world of desire. It's just that in the heaven realms, it's blissful, and in the higher heaven realms, you can think of anything and it arises. You know, so it's no effort to go and get something. If you want something, it arises. If you want a situation, it arises. But again, once that karma is exhausted, then there's a birth into the lower realm, usually. So the cause and effect works inexorably, and it also works, as I said, in positive ways. You plant good seeds, you get good results, and the life gets happier. You plant bad seeds, and the life gets worse. It's just how it is. And the fact that many, many people don't recognize that is part of why the world is such a mess. Because if people knew that and really understood it deeply in their hearts, then a lot of this negativity, wars and such, would be done with. Because we don't need that. You know, our minds can find a better solution. You know, we can learn to get along. So that's the law of cause and effect, the second of the noble truths. The third noble truth is the truth of cessation of suffering, the surcease of sorrow, if you will. And it says basically enlightenment is possible. It's possible to get healed from all this negativity and get to a new state of awareness and awakeness and happiness. And then the fourth noble truth is the path to the cessation. And that's where the practice comes in. Now, practicing the path goes in the direction of the cessation of sorrow. And in the original tradition, it was the Eightfold Path. You can look into that. It's still usable. In the Mahayana, we tend to exchange that for the six perfections which we practice. But I've discovered that trying to practice the Eightfold Path is pretty useful. And it's also fairly universal.
Why is that, Bob?
Why is it universal?
No, why is it, has it, in your experience, been useless?
No, it's not.
It's not?
I'm saying the opposite.
Oh, okay.
To the extent that I can practice it, it's very useful. You know, it really does clear a lot of things up. What happened with the Mahayana is that certain seeds in the original teaching produced ideas, doctrines. And some of those were picked up by the Mahayana and amplified, such as the key note, compassion. Compassion wasn't lacking in the early teachings. There exists some biographies of Buddha's previous lives called the Jataka Tales. And time again, he was called a bodhisattva, and he did compassionate action, lifetime after lifetime, to build up enough merit and wisdom so that he could become a Buddha. And likewise, the bodhisattvas, those who aspire to enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, not only for themselves to get out of samsara, but to help everybody else get out of samsara as well, to get out of the world of suffering. So the compassion existed from the get-go, but it wasn't overemphasized, so to speak. They have metta, which is a compassion exercise that's commonly used both in the Theravadan tradition and the Mahayana tradition. But the Mahayana tended to take some item of the teaching and run with it, amplify it. So there's a certain cosmic expansion in the Mahayana, the expansion of seed principles that did exist in the original teaching. And there's a set of prophecies about the Buddha Dharma. They say that in the first 500 years, that was the golden age of the Dharma. If you think of a chair, it's on four legs, it's solid. And during that time, the cream of the Dharma was available. After 500 years, arhatship was no longer fully possible. Now, this is from the academic point of view, from the wisdom point of view, it's not usually taught like that. In fact, I was instructed once not to teach it like that, because the deal was everybody was scrambling for this enlightenment, right? For their desire for enlightenment. So to tell them that it's not necessarily going to happen that way, and that there's no self to be enlightened, and so on. So the practice of the path does eventually get to a better and better state, and we can certainly achieve what's called the Satori in our current lifetime. To achieve full Buddhahood, with the Mahayana, they say it takes 3 eons. That's, again, a hyperbolic exaggeration, which the Mahayana is known for. It's very inspiring to have all this cosmic expansion going on. But however many eons it takes, when the Vajrayana came along, the Tantra, they said, oh, you can do all this in one lifetime. Or at the most, once you encounter the Vajrayana, in 17 lifetimes. Again, that might be metaphor, but the idea is there are accelerated paths within Buddhism that make it possible to attain enlightenment quicker, but it still takes a huge amount of effort. The Buddha's effort lasted lifetime after lifetime of compassionate action, and then he finally achieved the full enlightenment of a Buddha, which means he was a Tathagata, one that was fully autonomous, fully enlightened, able to do these incredible things. He started a Sangha that's lasted 2,500 years. You know, a huge accomplishment. Only full Buddhas can do things like that. All right, we'll pause. So you have the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path to the cessation of suffering as the foundation of the Buddhist teaching. And every subsequent idea and doctrine and teaching that emerged in Buddhism can be put under one or the other of these four truths. You know, the teachings about cause and effect, and so on. Every teaching in Buddhism fits under the outline of these four truths. So it's deep, and it needs to be plumbed in a deep way. We need to be reminded again and again of the Dharma so that it goes deep into the bones and eventually into the marrow, so to speak. Start again. Palpable feature of our experience is impermanence. Nothing lasts. Another feature is the huge amount of suffering in the samsaric world. A third feature is that nothing is personal. The principle of anatman, no self. This theory is unique to Buddhism. And if you add a fourth principle, namely nirvana is peace, you have what are called the four seals. And that determines whether or not you're a Buddhist. If you accept all four of those seals, then you're a Buddhist. most of the religions in the world don't accept the Anatman theory, the no-self theory. It was designed partly as a critique of the Hindu Atman theory. And, of course, there's a higher self in most traditions. That was one of the things that the Buddha did not answer. He had 14 questions that he refused to answer. Is there a soul or not? Is there a creation or not? And so on like that. I can't recite the 14 at this point. Those 14 things were not discussed because Buddha Dharma is essentially a method. And you can speculate all you want about creation, but does it transform your consciousness? Does it transform your psyche? Maybe it inspires you a little bit to think of the vastness of the creation. But Buddha steered clear of all that because it was metaphysical and secondary to the effort to clear up our situation and attain some kind of enlightenment. So the Anatman theory works in Buddhism as a method. I think that comes under the rubric of the 14 unanswerable questions. And certainly anything that we think of as a self is not really a self. It's all the process of the skandhas. You know, we identify with our job, we identify with our house and car, we identify with our bodies. None of those are ourselves. So if there is a self in the vast cosmos, it's nothing we have any experience with. And it also, by believing in it, doesn't necessarily transform your consciousness. So in Buddhism, there's no self. And likewise, some people, hoping to gain a positive attitude, ignore the suffering. They try to make everything nicey-nice. And that's okay. That's one way to structure your psyche. You simply deny the suffering. But it ultimately doesn't lead to transformation either. Likewise, impermanence. At the time that the Buddha devised that, impermanence was not so obvious. The grandparent had a similar experience to the grandchild because things changed only very slowly. So to make it a principle that things are impermanent sounded pretty strange at the time, you know, in 600 BC or whenever it was. Now it's in everybody's face. You know, we see impermanence every day. Things are changing so fast we can't keep up. So the truth of impermanence is now palpable, whereas before it was not so obvious. So you have suffering, impermanence, and not-self, said to be the three characteristics of samsara, the world of suffering. Okay, another start. If you want to do Buddhist practice, it's traditionally structured in a triad. What are called the three trainings. The first training is in ethics. The second training is meditation and concentration. And the third training is wisdom. And all three are needed in order to make good progress on the path. Buddhist ethics is practically universal. Most of the rule books for humans in this world are very similar, partly because our situation is very similar. So in the case of Buddhism, there are 10 things to avoid. Avoid killing, and, you know, even small animals, if possible. Where you draw the line is pretty much up to the individual. If I've got an infection, I'm going to kill those critters. One time here at the Dharma Center, we had a bunch of termites, carpenter ants. There's no question, you have to kill them. They're going to eat your house if you don't. But that doesn't mean you like to kill them. And it doesn't mean there isn't some karmic feedback from killing them. But in that case, practically, it would be necessary. And, you know, you can carry it to an extreme, which produces a change in consciousness as well. I heard of one monk in the tropical lands that wouldn't kill mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes were attached to his skin and drinking the blood, and they got fatter and fatter, and he just left them there. You know, it must have been a little bit excruciating, you know, the itch that he got as a result. But that was his practice at the time. So, again, you can follow these precepts, these ethical principles, to whatever level of detail you want or you feel comfortable with. But certainly we don't want to kill humans. And most people wouldn't pull the wings off of butterflies and that sort of thing that some kids don't know better to do. So that's the precept of non-killing. Then there's non-stealing. Not taking what is not given is the exact definition of that. And again, I don't know about you, but I stole when I was a kid. I didn't know any better, and I gradually learned better. You know, I got caught a few times and got corrected in that sense. Then there's another thing you can do with the rule book. You can take all these actions to avoid and try to enhance their opposite action, such as rather than kill, you try to enhance life whenever possible. Rather than steal, you be generous. The third thing to avoid is sexual misconduct, which is pretty much culture bound. You know, some aspects of sexuality are forbidden in some cultures and encouraged in others. I think the principle, I saw that on a sheet of precepts from a Zen school. It said, honor the body, do not misuse sexuality. And, you know, it reminds us sexuality is sacred. You know, it's a deep mystery. So the misusing of it. Coercion is one way. Promiscuity is another way. You know, a lot of ways to misuse sexuality. And they basically, the precept says, don't do it. Okay, those are the three main rules about the body. Then there are four about speech. We want to avoid our negative speech. So, no lying. Don't lie, manifest the truth. Then no harsh speech. Nasty talk. You know, if you have to criticize something, do it to their face and as kindly as possible, rather than nastily. So no harsh speech. No slander and backbiting. You know, talking negatively about somebody behind their back. You know, just avoid that kind of speech behavior, or try to. You know, it's hard not to gossip sometimes when you're in a group of people that are into gossip. But, you know, if you watch your tongue, you don't say anything negative about the person whose situation got brought up in a group. So there are ways to follow that rule, even though we get in slippery places with the rules all the time because of our situation, because of our past negative karma, and because of other people's behavior. So it's not easy to clean up the act, because you get lots of negative feedback from the outside society. And the fourth of the things to avoid with speech is idle chatter. You know, that affects some people more than others. But just chattering on with no meaning, with no depth to it, is a waste of energy. And in my case, I was a chatterbox. And luckily, I got some help in clearing that up. So I was able to start leaving gaps for other people to enter the conversation, right? And so following these rules as deeply as possible means rapid progress in the ethical plane. Then the hardest of the 10 things to avoid are the three of mind. And we want to avoid malicious thoughts. And we don't have control over our thinking, so it's hard not to have a malicious thought once in a while. So rather than beat ourselves up about it, we note I had a malicious thought. And, you know, accept it and look at it and hopefully not have that malicious thought again. Likewise, a covetous, greedy thought, we don't want to have those. And the third difficulty of mind that we want to avoid is what are called false views. Distorted views, such as not believing that your actions have an effect. You know, there are innumerable, there's said to be 62 possible false views. So false views can get very, very subtle, and it's still a false view. It's not seeing things clearly the way they really are, both internally and externally. That's the goal. So that that summarizes the 10 things to avoid. That's the ethical part of the trainings. Meditation and concentration. I did mention the basic mindfulness meditation. In Buddha Dharma, potentially it goes a lot deeper than that. If you sit mindfully a lot, you get into states of shamatha, which is focused mind, meditation that has one-pointed focus in it. And that's really useful for examining the psyche. Then through shamatha, you can get what's called access concentration to the four dhyanas, which are the progressively deeper phases of meditation. The word zen is actually a transliteration of the word dhyana. So it means deep concentration. And then beyond the four dhyanas are the four formless states, which are so subtle that they practically don't exist. And you can have your mind in a formless state if you've done that much practice. Okay, you have ethics and concentration, and then wisdom. And that's a very big topic that I don't want to start too deeply on. But basically, in Buddha Dharma, wisdom consists in the recognition of the emptiness of all phenomena. And then there's also practical wisdom, how things work, how to do devotional rituals, you know, how to build a building. All that is a kind of practical wisdom. And then the spiritual wisdom involves taking the view of emptiness in all cases. The famous Heart Sutra that we chanted at the beginning summarizes the wisdom in 25 lines. It requires a lot of explanation in order to get to the depth of it. But basically, it says you need to practice the view of emptiness to say that these things have no intrinsic existence. And you start with the self. You know, I'm not the same person, the same self as I was at age 10. You know, at age 20, it's different again, and so on. So the self is not permanent. And then the next step is to say, okay, it's empty of any essential nature. It's like a soap bubble. You know, it's like a lightning flash. There's nothing solid in it. It's like a rainbow. It seems to be there sometimes, but there's really nothing to it if you examine it. It's a phenomenon, but it has no intrinsic solid nature of any sort. So the first view of wisdom then is to say that the self is empty. And that's not even in the Heart Sutra, that's taken for granted, you know, as a beginning. And then the second thing the Heart Sutra says is that the skandhas themselves are empty, even though they're categories of these essential atoms of experience, these essential experiences. They're basically without any intrinsic nature of their own. They have no separate self-entity, nothing does. And that's the Mahayana version of emptiness. So wisdom is about emptiness. It's about realizing that things are fluid, impermanent, and that they have no separate self-entity, no intrinsic existence. Okay, I reversed it. The handout then has the bit about Buddhist ethics. I should have covered this earlier, but it works. There's what are called four thoughts that turn the mind towards the spiritual path, that turn the mind to Dharma. And these, again, are pretty well universal. The first of the four thoughts is that the human life is precious, especially a human life that has leisure and opportunity to practice the spiritual path, to practice Dharma. It's very rare. If you look at the 7 billion people in this world, how many of them, even if they wanted to, could practice the Dharma? You know, they're in countries where no Dharma exists. They're in a war zone. They're caught up in their daily doings to such an extent that they're way too busy. So there's no opportunity to practice Dharma or no inclination to practice Dharma. So a really precious human life is one where the Dharma opens up as a possibility and it can be practiced. That's very rare in this world. And then you add the larger time span. There are dark eons where no Buddha appears. The Buddha in this world appeared 2,500 years ago, and his teaching still exists, so it's possible to practice the Dharma. Then, as I started to say, the 500 years of the golden age of the Dharma is past, and then you have two 500-year periods of what is called the appearance of Dharma, where temples are built, statues are made, stupas are made, there's a lot of pious activity, but something in the Dharma has already been forgotten. And then after that 1,000 years begins a long stretch called the Dharma ending age. And the truth of the Dharma gradually decays the way everything in this world of time decays. So it gets more and more losted, forgotten as time goes on. You know, in this country, it's totally obscure. I mean, Buddhism out of the off the radar. You know, out of the circle of understanding. And then the story goes, at the end of the Dharma ending age, there's a king. And this king offers half of his kingdom with all his armies and elephants and riches, treasures, half of his kingdom. If somebody can come up with one four-line stanza of the Good Dharma, and when no one can, it's gone. And it stays gone until a new Buddha arises. Now we're in what's called the fortunate eon. The story is Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth Buddha in this eon. And in this eon, there's 1,000 Buddhas, but an eon is a huge amount of time. You know, more than 2,200 years, which is another definition of eon. You know, this means an extensive span of time. And so there'll be 996 more Buddhas before this eon ends, before the universe is destroyed. But they'll be all over, you know, how many planets are there in 100 billion stars in one galaxy, and 100 billion galaxies at least. So not every Buddha is going to be born on every planet. So it's rare. And it's so precious that we need to avail ourselves of the opportunity to practice the Dharma. Even to the small extent that we still can, realizing that, okay, something has still been forgotten, you know, but there's much that has not been forgotten, and we have the possibility and the aspiration to practice that. Okay. Wind up here. I want to get back to compassion. The original teachings contain what are called the Brahma Vihara, the stations of Brahma, stations of the Creator, actually. In Buddhism, the Creator is one of the lower heaven worlds, and the Creator does function to produce the world as we know it. And so to get to that heaven world, which is very lofty, you practice the four Brahma Viharas, which are Karuna, compassion, Maitri, loving kindness, Mudita, joy, and Upeksha, equanimity. And there are various ways to practice those four immeasurables. In one of them, you take each in turn and you apply it to yourself, to those closest to you, to those neutral persons, people that you may not even know, but you have a neutral attitude towards, and then to your enemies, wishing your enemies having the release of suffering and the causes of suffering. Wishing your enemies happiness and the causes of happiness. Wishing your enemies joy. Wishing your enemies a balanced equanimity, non-reactivity, a kind of open, neutral emotion. And then you wish all sentient beings those same four immeasurables. Called immeasurable because they can be infinitely applied, and there's no boundaries to the amount of compassion that can be generated. Then it's possible to take them individually, you know, contemplate joy for a good while, joy and joyfulness. When somebody is happy, be happy with them, rather than being envious that they have something that you don't got. You know, so it's a matter, again, of clearing up the internal negativities. And, you know, it's easier to do that in the abstract. You know, I think of the happy people in that monastery in Nepal, and how happy I am that they're happy, even though I can't be there. You know, so gradually our envy and jealousy are cleared up by the practice of joy. Likewise, practicing compassion, self-compassion, is necessary, and in this society especially, because in our culture, we tend to not give ourselves a break at all. We're always beating ourselves up. We have a portion of our mind is the critic, and the critic will always tell you how rotten you are, how you made a bad mistake, and on and on and on. Okay, so self-compassion begins to remove that negativity in the mind. Likewise, loving kindness. You know, I know for a fact that when we connect with somebody and there's a lot of positive energy that's exchanged, you know, that's loving kindness. And it's a much better moment than the other moment when we're turning away from somebody or actively pushing them away. So we want to neither pull nor push. But I'll end with something that I heard in an assembly that is about loving kindness. And it's something that you say again for yourself, for your close ones, your loved ones and your friends, for your acquaintances and neutral people, and for all sentient beings. And it goes like this. May you be safe from inner and outer harm. May you be free from guilt, shame, and hatred. May you enjoy physical and mental well-being. May you live with the ease of an open heart. May you go beyond your inner darkness and awaken to your radiant true nature as boundless love. And I hope that covered most of basic Buddhism. You need to hear it again and again, but that's a start.
Can we hear the last things you said again, please?
Ah, yes.
Thank you.
I can send you an email with it. Yeah, but I'll say it again anyway. May you be safe from inner and outer harm. May you be free from guilt, shame, and hatred. May you enjoy physical and mental well-being. May you live with the ease of an open heart. may you go beyond your inner darkness and awaken to your radiant true nature as boundless love. And that's all she wrote.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
No.
Questions, huh?
Questions, okay. If there are some, bound to be some.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between attainments and ethics? Can you have high attainments without ethics?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, you can. And that's the left-hand path, the dark path. There are stories in India about people that practice very hard, assiduously. They practice ascetic practices. If you practice asceticism, you gain power. And that power can be misused. So there are cases where yogis have gone astray ethically and gained huge amounts of power. Then they become demonic. And these demons can get so bad that it takes an avatar, like Krishna comes down to the earth to defeat certain of the demons that were originally yogis that practiced all of these difficult practices and then misused their power in the worst way. So, unfortunately, as I said, you can achieve great attainments without the ethics. But without the ethics, you spiral down into terrible negativity. So, in Buddha Dharma, as indeed in most religious practices, the ethics are stressed at the beginning. The view being that until the ethics clear up, you shouldn't learn any powerful practices, for one thing, and if the ethics are not clear, you can't even learn the basic ideas. So, again, ethics is not usually mentioned with the Buddha Dharma. You know, we have a kind of New Age approach to the Dharma that makes, again, everything sound really good. But, you know, there are difficulties in this world system. It's a pretty bad world we're in. And a lot of the negative things go on. So there is the possibility of attaining powers that can be misused. And in Buddha Dharma, it's said some of these powers are side effects of good practice. But they're not to be sought out, and they're not to be displayed. There's a story of a couple monks that are walking along, and they come to a stream. And the one monk wades across the stream, and the water is, up to the calves, so it's pretty swift and hard to do. The other monk floats across the river, flies across the river, and the first monk, who's older, won't have anything further to do with him until he goes back across the river and wades across it like any ordinary person. You know, because it's vainglorious to display powers for no reason. Conversely, I heard a story about one of the lamas of Tibet that encountered a bus that was going off the cliff. And in Tibet, there are precipices. You have a cliff going down this way. You have the road, usually a dirt road, barely two lanes. And then, boom, another precipice off the other side. And every once in a while, a bus or a vehicle goes over the precipice, and it's like doom. You know, all the people die. It's not just going off the shoulder of the road. It's like falling sometimes hundreds of feet. So somehow, he was able to reverse the process. And as the bus started going over, actually pushed time back and prevented the accident. Now, that's hard to believe, but they say it happened. And there are a lot of stories out there of unusual phenomena And some of these things can happen. But again, that was the use of a power that was a positive use and a necessary use. Mere display for vainglorious ends is forbidden in the Buddha Dharma. And again, some people that are not so spiritual may get into trouble with the powers that they generate. So it said, don't seek after them. They're a natural side effect of the higher parts of the path, and they're not to be misused.